Hello, this is Jill Pasternak. Welcome to Crossover, the program that explores the universal language, music. Music of Johann Sebastian Bach as you never heard it before, performed by the Canadian Brass with a little bit of jive. That was the Well-Tempered Clavier, an excerpt, the Fugue No. 2 in C minor, performed by the Canadian Brass live in our studios here at WRTI. I'm Jill Pasternak here with a very entertaining group, the Canadian Brass, and they are known for many, many years. We actually have Chuck Dallenbach, who is probably one of the original of the group. Chuck, you look well and happy and young and beaming, and welcome here to WRTI.
Well, thank you so much. Nice to talk to you again. This is really nice for us to be here. And indeed, I am very happy. As you can see, this the average age of the group is going down.
It's going down, and I think for our audience, I was going to say, this is what incarnation is this of the Canadian Brass?
Well, really, I kind of just divided it in two. We had the original group that started in 1970, and we were already different ages at that time, so it was quite obvious. You don't think about that when you're starting of the other end, but it was obvious that there would be a certain attrition at a certain point. And I think the four gentlemen in front of you here really feel that this will be the next incarnation of the Canadian Brass. So it's the ground floor of round two.
This is a wonderful thing to know because, you know, we become attached to artists, to musicians, and then they're gone and they're not there. But you're carrying on a tradition, and it's really wonderful to hear you once again performing together. And I guess it's new music, isn't it, Chuck? I mean, what is your repertoire? You're always looking for new ones. You have this appearance here at Temple where you'll be playing, I think, is it an arrangement of Luther Henderson, of a Bach? Something from the Well-Tempered Clavier?
Well, we have the Luther Henderson, who is a very important contributor to our repertoire, but we're also performing Bernstein, the Music of the Mass, which people don't really hear that often. It's such a mixture of styles, even in that one work. So we have a smaller work derived from that, which right in the middle features perhaps one of the greatest compositions from the 20th century, The Simple Song,
which yes, that's wonderful.
Brandon actually gets to play the trumpet solo in that piece.
Now, Brandon, you are, we have two trumpets here, don't we? We have Brandon and?
Chris, right here.
Chris Coletti.
Chris Coletti.
And how does that work? I mean, that's not like in the orchestra where you have first trumpet and second trumpet, is it?
Well, we have a Canadian brass coin, actually, that we flip, and it has two heads on each side, and I always call heads, so I usually get to play whatever I want.
Yeah,
so I always call the right one.
How do you deal with that, Chuck? As being the maestro,
the best we figured this out early on with these two, is to not deal with it. They somehow, they come up, they share the book, they take turns, and they seem to understand each other's abilities. And really, we hear them offering the solos to each other more than we hear them trying to take the solos. So it's quite wonderful.
I think that's called cowardice at some point, isn't it?
Well, it helps to see first trumpet on both parts, too.
Well, I think it's that good for help. Your ego, isn't it? I really, really do. Now, we also have we have a trombonist who is Keith.
Yeah, hi.
And Keith, tell us a little bit about how long you've been here. Have you all started at the same time? Was that it? Is that the way it happened? Or did you come?
I think each person, whoever is the most recent, thinks that's where it started. So Keith is actually a good one to ask that question.
Yeah. No, I joined the group about a year ago. Last May, I believe, was my first concert in Eastern Canada. And it's been a whirlwind ever since. We've been in the almost a year now that I've been in the group, we've been to China and Venezuela and all over this continent, and it's been the experience of a lifetime.
Yeah, sure. I'm sure it is, Keith Derda, and finally we have our we have our French horn player who is very elite. That's a very elite instrument. I've always felt that way about
Absolutely. That.
And that's Eric.
Yes.
Eric Reed. And Eric, you've been all... Now, again, you've also joined at different times or essentially pretty much around the same time?
We've all joined at different times. I'm actually the most recent addition to the group. I've been around for about 8 months.
Did you know what you were getting into when you...
A little bit. The history of the group is one that, all five of us have grown up with.
In awe, I think, in awe, because the Canadian brass has been the standard of excellence, I must say, even for people that don't know anything about brass instruments or wind instruments. One thing I have found, I'm a musician myself through the years playing in orchestras, that the brass section is so funny. I mean, everybody is very clever and very funny, so you must have a lot of fun together as well. So, Chuck, tell us a little bit about how you arrive at repertoire. Is that a choice? Is that done together, or do you really kind of...
I think there's really three aspects of repertoire. One is a sort of standard brass repertoire, which is pretty slim, frankly. Our medium is quite new. Brass quintet traces its real roots back to the late 40s. So we missed the Beethoven and Haydn string quartet era and all of that sort of thing. So we have the standard brass repertoire. Then we have the masterpiece, which is reaching out for music by Bach and Handel, and really just picking off the very finest examples of great Western art music, which gives us a great opportunity, actually, not being bound to, a mediocre repertoire. And then the new music. We're constantly commissioning. I think at this point we've commissioned something like over 80 compositions. And one is one that we're actually playing here in Philadelphia. We're playing the work by Bramwell Tovey. Tovey is an English composer from Canada. And he wrote a wonderful work for us, just featuring the brass out in front of the large ensemble. And then even in our own group, we have very talented arrangers. Chris and Brandon have both made important arrangements for recordings, and then Brandon himself is a composer, and I think you've just had your first work put into print, internationally available from the mighty, powerful Hal Leonard Publishing Corporation, so we know that it will have international distribution. Thank you.
From their album Legends, we heard the very popular Arrival of the Queen of Sheba by George Friedrich Handel, arranged for the brass by Michael Allen.
And that really leads to recordings.
I was just going to ask you about recordings, and in this day and age of difficulty recording, are you feeling that at all? Anybody want? That's just a question I'm throwing out to all of you.
That's a good Eric question, because you did mention the horn being the esoteric instrument.
Yeah.
Somehow there's a different approach to music. When a horn player says something about music, people take it very seriously.
But he looks, the instrument looks very intellectual.
Absolutely.
And you have to have your head examined to play it, because I really think it's a gorgeous sound, but it's very difficult, isn't it?
Well, I mean, just going to say that. You took the words out of my mouth. It really comes down to the difficulty, actually. no one in their right mind chooses the French horn, but once they do, they realize how beautiful it is and how we get to play all the really nice, beautiful melodies and solos.
He's smiling, the audience. He is smiling. but everyone is. I think there is so much, the technique and the technical difficulties of all of the instruments are mastering brass instruments and any instrument for that matter. But you have created a culture with the Canadian brass.
I think that's what we're all feeling, and you alluded to it earlier, that the Canadian brass now has become a bit of an institution.
Yes.
Like there's not a brass player coming along today that isn't aware of the Canadian brass in some way or another, including the fact that we've been very involved with education all along, and we created a set of books, a masterpiece approach to performance, so that very young players could play very wonderful music and do so very early on. As a ensemble, as a chamber music ensemble. And there are something like 500,000 of these books out around the world. So invariably we'll be in Germany or Austria or Japan, and kids will show up with these books and want them autographed. They're actually growing up in this style. So we think that we have really popularized the idea of chamber music for brass instruments.
Is it unique? I mean, is it different for strings? I mean, I would think that chamber music essentially is always listening to everybody. You know, when you play, that's essentially what it is. And you teach ensemble, which is the root of orchestral playing as well. So I just wondered if it's any different with wind instruments. Anybody?
Well, it really comes down to interaction. You know, in a small group such as ours, we're able to not only interact more easily with each other to create a really enjoyable performance, but also to interact with the audience and to make it a
fun. I know
fun
you're known for that.
For everyone. Yeah. Thank you.
yet again a very well-known march, the Earl of Oxford's March by William Byrd, arranged by Michael Allen for the Canadian Brass, who performed this on their album Legends. Well, I will say this, though. The more I talk to you about this, the more I realize how close it is to the mystique of improvisation and jazz, because jazz essentially is the players listen to each other. I think that classical players listen to each other, or should, but I think in a sense, jazz musicians, they don't really think like they're doing something really terrific, that they're listening to the other person. It's something you have to do in jazz, whereas in classical, although you have to do it, it's written there for you, and I say that as a classical musician. So I've always admired jazz players for their ability to improvise, but also to listen, and I think that's a terribly important thing in the ensemble. Canadian Brass performing Sweet Georgia Brown from their album Swing That Music, which is a tribute to the late Louis Armstrong. You have any recordings out, new ones?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question. Recordings are very central to our really creating a repertoire. It always gives us the impulse to create new repertoire. And we have one that, two things. Very unusual situation has occurred. We are at the top of the Billboard charts. We're now into our seventh week. And interestingly enough, it's Christmas music.
Well,
enjoying this at this time of year. And coming up right behind it, because we're coming up to July 4th, this past year we released a recording called Stars and Stripes, which is American, it's not folk, but patriotic music. Mm-hmm. And Brandon and Chris, I mentioned that they're both very fine arrangers, did the lion's share of the arranging for that piece. And it includes traditional percussion, the kind of drum you would see in a picture of the Civil War or something, the rope, where they're tuned with ropes and so forth. So we did a real traditional patriotic recording, and that seems to see a nice response as we're coming up to July 4th. So here we go again.
Music of John Philip Sousa, The Stars and Stripes Forever, a very, very familiar tune from the album Stars and Stripes by the Canadian Brass. How many recordings have you done in this, as I say, this reincarnation of the Canadian Brass?
Well, we've already have several. Brandon has actually, although he looks very young, he looks like he's, well, for the radio audience, just to let you know, because we're all looking at him right now, I'd say he looks 16 or 17.
Yeah, I was going to say 15.
But he's already been in the group for 5 years. So Brandon is on many of our recordings, and Chris as well, as the companion trumpet with Brandon, is now on the lion's share. And we're about to release two recordings, one coming up very soon, which is the music of Brahms, which is a composer that was rather elusive for us. We all love the music of Brahms.
Yes.
We've been at the back of orchestras playing the big Brahms symphonies, which features brass nicely, and individual instruments can be involved here and there, but as a quintet, taking this on as chamber music was really a challenge. And again, Brandon and Chris did the Brahms waltzes, 16.
Oh, the Liebeslied?
Waltzes.
The piano waltzes.
The piano waltzes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And it turned out, unbeknownst to me when we first all met, but they both have pianistic skills. They could easily.
I think you're gradually, as you're speaking, discovering all various talents that they possess. You know, it's really quite wonderful. But the arrangements of waltzes, and of course, I think that would really fit with a. What happens to the beat? Who does that? Who oompas?
Well, we'll let you take one guess.
Yeah, can't get away from it.
Yeah. Tuba just plays bass line so beautifully.
It's
a lot better than a trumpet.
I have to ask you something, Chuck. I saw your tuba, and it's got a black bell. It looks like it's black.
It is. It's carbon fiber.
Is that a new
thing? I think I'm the only person in the world that plays a carbon fiber bell, and we're very slow in this industry to make changes. The valve, the reason that we can play what we do, the chamber music, the valve for our instruments was invented, the year it's given is usually 1834-35.
And the brass music started when, in what year, in the Renaissance?
Well, and there's a picture of a tuba from 1860 that looks just like a tuba someone would play today. So I sort of always think about it as a golfer standing out there at the PGA, and they're about to take their first teeing off with a wood club. It wouldn't happen. Yeah, we're playing instruments that look identical to the way they did 150 years ago. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, carbon fiber seemed to intrigue me. It's used in the speaker industry for a very fast-responding material, and it worked very well for the tuba. Cellos are now made out of carbon fiber. There's several professional orchestras where you'll find two or three cellos playing carbon fiber. Carbon fiber bows, and there's a flute made in Denmark.
Is it lighter, much lighter than brass?
It's extremely light, but more importantly, it's very resonant material. It vibrates so quickly, so you get more result for the same amount of energy. And who wouldn't want that?
Well, that's progress, I guess.
Exactly.
And you can drive 30 yards farther, too.
Yeah.
Eventually, we'll all have tailor-made titanium instruments.
Well, it's really, you laugh, but I think, you know, things, the times are a change, and I'm being a harpist. They're making plastic harps, so you wonder about that, unbreakable. But I really think the times are changing, and the music business has always been very peripatetic, but somehow you have survived as an ensemble. Certainly the idea of Canadian brass has survived, and I'm sure that it will continue and you will add to it so beautifully and add to the repertoire. Thank you for taking the time to be with us today. You're playing this evening with the Temple Wind Ensemble, I guess, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be quite exciting as well. But good luck to you all, and we will be buying all of your new releases. Thanks for coming to WRTI and Crossover. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Just heard the Battaglia Gaillarde by Samuel Scheidt, performed live in our studios by our guests today, the Canadian Brass. You're listening to Crossover on WRTI. ¶¶ Bach on the banjo. We've just heard music of Johann Sebastian Bach, the Gavotte en Rondo, performed by our guest today, Michael Miles. We have a returning guest, one of our favorites here at WRTI, Michael Miles. Welcome back to Crossover, Michael.
Thank you, Jill. It's great to be back.
You are so prolific. I don't know where you find the time to do everything you do, but incidentally, you have a wonderful new album, and I'd love to talk about that. But to begin with, you are a banjo player, or do you call it a banjoist?
either one is fine. Banjo player, banjoist. I don't believe I've
that ever
word
heard.
Has crossed my lips too many times. Although I've seen it in print now and then, and a composer, and a guitarist, and a singer. So, but banjo has always been kind of the centerpiece and a place where I've channeled a lot of my energy and my new compositions.
Well, you are also a historian, I think, because the things that you have done have incorporated, outside of the actual recordings that we're going to talk about today, the performances that you give are really a combination of, music and, I guess, photography, art, discussion of the of politics and literature, history. Isn't that what you include?
Yes. Yeah, I call them musical documentaries for the stage, mixing music, politics, literature, and humor. And in recent years, I've started incorporating as well a rear screen projection imagery. So that brings the world to life on the stage in a different way.
Yes. Well, of course, how did you start to begin with? I mean, were you you played the banjo? Were you a teacher at any point in your life in the beginning?
No, I did not. My undergraduate degree in college was in oral interpretation of literature, and which is kind of mixing theater and literary criticism. But I always leaned more towards music, and I taught myself to play the guitar, and I taught myself to play the banjo, and found myself drawn towards incorporating on stage literature and music, and those are the issues that oral interpretation looks to. A stage non-dramatic material. So you take Walt Whitman, you take Carl Sandburg, you take Pete Seeger's testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee, or whatever, and add music that puts it in a context that underscores it, that enhances it, that brings it to life somehow, and so that from those stage productions, like my one-man show that is titled From Senegal to Seeger, Stories of the American Banjo, it has all of that incorporated into it. And the CD, simultaneously to those stage productions, I've been working as a composer but I was not really doing composition until I first recorded those Bach cello suites, the first and third cello suites that we've talked about before, having recorded them, and of course they're never actually ever really finished, but having recorded them, I awarded myself a grassroots PhD.
And well, you deserve it. Before we go on any further, you are a clawhammerist, I guess,
yes,
or as a banjoist.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, what is the difference between, first of all, you play a banjo, so what's the difference between a banjo and a mandolin for our audience?
Well, a banjo is the biggest difference, a banjo is a drum-based string instrument. So the body of the banjo is a drum. And the mandolin and the guitar all those other wooden instruments, that's a wooden box, you know, different shapes, different strings, different pitches, different setups. But the, you know, to think about guitar versus banjo, guitar is all wood, banjo is a drum. And so the interesting thing about the drum-based string instruments is that that technology grew up all over the world. In the banjo in America came to America from Africa, but there's drum-based string instruments in Japan and Tibet and India and China, all over the world. And so this particular tonality, which is a little sharper than the warmth of a wooden instrument, comes from the drum-based string instrument.
Well, what you have done, though, is now the clawhammer. What is that, a style of playing?
And clawhammer is a word that refers to a right-hand technique. And the more people are familiar with the technique that either a classical guitarist would use is finger picking, which is similar to what a bluegrass banjo player would do, picking up on the strings. And clawhammer is an ancient way of playing strings, where in fact the only point of contact is a finger striking down on the string. So when I go to play, it's the nail of my middle finger hitting down on the string versus picking up on it, and a thumb. So there's two points of contact.
Yeah, when you play the guitar, though, you press on the string, don't you? Do you pick?
On the guitar, I'll finger pick the guitar like a classical guitarist. I'll do finger. It's called finger style guitar. It's the same techniques as a classical guitarist, or play with a flat pick. But if you can picture a classical guitarist's hand, the strings are being, you know, he squeezes and pulls the strings up. And clawhammer banjo, you're coming down on it. And what's interesting about that is one of my miscellaneous tours, I've been in Morocco a couple of times, and I met in Morocco a guy who played an instrument called the hajouj, which is a three-string Berber instrument, great big drum-based string instrument that this dates back 500 or 600 years. And sure enough, he played it, clawhammer style. And when I saw him play, it was chilling to me because here was I taught myself. I grew up in Chicago.
Place to learn how to play the banjo.
Yes, right. And his right hand and my right hand were very much the same. And it was wild to see that, you know, I felt like this sudden link, and it was thrilling and chilling to see it, his hand. And then, and then when he saw me play, and saw that, you know, our hands resembled one another, it was, you know, entirely odd for him for a completely different set of reasons. Yeah. But nonetheless, you know, we kind of became friends, and he subsequently built me a hajouj and sent me one that I have here in Chicago.
Which will probably eventually be the subject of another album. Of Michael Miles from his Suite for the Americas, we heard the Courante, with Michael on banjo and the Chamber Blues String Quartet. Whenever we talk about you and your and what you do, it really incorporates so very, very much. And you have, of course, become a real ambassador, I think. Your music is a universal language, as we always say, and you have certainly used it in the traveling that you've done and the connections that you've made and the friendships that you've made all over the world. But this particular album that you've done has incorporated some other performers as well. Now, you are utilizing a string quartet here?
Yes, on this recording there is a string quartet, a couple of singers, as well as vibes, trumpet, flugelhorn, a drum set, electric bass, and hand percussion, and then miscellaneous banjos. And I must say that I wanted to, as a piece of this album, to point to my engineer and producer, because this took several years to make, and his name is Mike Lapchick, and he was a real partner in this, because it's like this recording was an adventure down the path of what is possible with the banjo. So half of the tracks are with banjo and string quartet. And it's a working string quartet called the Chamber Blues String Quartet that they generally tour with this amazing harmonica player out of Chicago named Corky Siegel and Chamber Blues. And so it's his string quartet. And then the other players are Chicago, like Philadelphia. There's an array of fantastic musicians who are a phone call away, who are interested and available and interesting projects. And I happen to be the beneficiary of the presence of all of them.
Well, but you certainly are creative, and this album illustrates it so beautifully. You never quite know what the next track is going to bring. Is this a compilation of ideas that you had over a period of time? Or I know that the Bach was something that you had worked on, and it's unique because the banjo and, people have not heard it. You've been working on that for quite a long time, I think. And is it difficult to transcribe his work into the banjo mode, or what is it that fascinates you, of course, because it's Bach, I guess?
I feel my first foray were those cello suites, the first and third cello suites, and it's very difficult to play. And Bach is pass-fail, and pass is like 98% and above, and fail is 97% and below. From a player's perspective, if you miss a few notes, you walk away feeling not really great. I had a really good friend, actually, Margaret James, who did a number of the orchestrations here. She said, "I love to play Bach at home, you know." I found that the tunefulness, I mean, Bach has a number of characteristics to his work, and one of those characteristics is this beautiful tunefulness. And the influence of the Renaissance era of music and early Baroque, there's melodies that are kind of folky melodies, you know, they're hummable, like Sleepers Awake. It's a hummable famous tune. You hear that, and if somebody said, how does that go? You can hum it, you know, and some of the harmonies are impossible to hum, but there's that aspect of it, that tuneful, hummable, beautiful, melodies that Bach created that have their roots in the music that was around him, preceded him.
I think that you've touched on something, and Beethoven also used folk melodies in some of his symphonies. You know, that's exactly what was going on. They were really music of their time that was for the common man, I guess, at some point. You know, people were singing things, humming things. They had folk tunes.
Absolutely.
And that's probably, you know, one doesn't think about that too much, especially in the greatness and the magnificence of some of the Bach works. Music of Johann Sebastian Bach, the very well-known Sleepers Awake, Wacht auf, with Michael Miles and Ensemble performing, joined by vocalist Sue Demmel. Michael, pleasure. It's just been wonderful. Never enough time to speak with you because we have to kind of skim what's on the top of the list because you're always doing something. And I just thank you so much. This is a marvelous album. Not only is it, I enjoyed it tremendously. I think it's varied and it's quite delightful, really delightful. And that's not a very, maybe not a strong enough word, but it just brings one into a mood of you know, you change with each selection. It's the change of mood. It's a variety, and it is a collage, exactly a collage.
Right.
And we thank you for it.
Well, I so appreciate your support, Jill, and your interest in my work, and I count my lucky stars that I actually get to do the things that I do. I had a little third grade boy asked me if it was hard to be a musician. And I thought, well, an interesting question. I said, well, to tell you the truth, I have to do a concert tomorrow night and I have a sore throat and I'm a little worried about it. But you know what's hard? That's harder. The guys who are out in the street, you know, building the roads and digging the ditches and picking up the trash, that's hard. You and me, I happen to be in this room with you and we're about to sing a song together. So what a joyful thing that I get to do, and how I ended up being able to do this, I don't know, but I'm so grateful that I am, and glad to be able to take what gifts I've been given and turn around and share them with everybody, including, you know, the people who enjoy the CD and little kids who want to learn how to sing Shine on Harvest Moon, stuff like that.
So. Well, that's it in a nutshell, Michael. So thanks again. Great, great, great album. And also lots of luck in your trip. Be careful. You're going into a busy part of the world right now. So,
I will.
Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Jill.
Thanks,
I really appreciate
again.
It.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
For a second listen to selected Crossover interviews, visit WRTI.org. Crossover was produced by Jill Pasternak in the studios of WRTI Philadelphia for the WRTI Radio Network. This is Joe Patti, Crossover's technical producer. Crossover is syndicated nationally by Global Media Group Incorporated. Thanks for listening.